wrapped his arms around me. But at this juncture, where would that have gotten anybody? I freed my hands and put a palm on the smooth skin of his cheek, taking comfort in the well-counseled patience for that which bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, and, most importantly, endures them. You're a sweet one, Tinker Gray. The elevator cables whooshed past as the car approached. I dropped my hand before Hamilton pulled back the elevator door. Tinker nodded and put his hands in his jacket pockets. "Thanks for the eggs," he said. "Don't make too much of it. It's the only thing I know how to cook." Tinker smiled, showing a flash of his normal self. I got on the elevator. "We didn't get a chance to talk about your new place," he said. "Can I come by and see it? Maybe next week?"
"That would be great."
Hamilton was waiting respectfully for the conversation to end. "Okay, Hamilton," I said. He closed the gate and pulled the lever, initiating our descent, and then he whistled a little tune to himself as he watched the floors pass. After the Civil War, the names of the founding fathers, like Washington and Jefferson, became plenty popular with his race. But here was the first Negro I'd ever met, named after the death-by-dueling proponent of the central bank. When we reached the lobby, I stepped off the elevator and turned to ask him about that. But a bell rang, and he gave a shrug. The great brass doors of the elevator quietly closed. They were embossed with a dragon-crested shield inscribed with the motto of the Beresford, "Fronta nulla fides." Place no trust in appearances.
I'll say.
Despite the fact that the groundhog had cast no shadow, winter laid siege on New York for another 3 weeks. The crocuses froze in Central Park. The songbirds, reaching the only sensible conclusion, doubled back to Brazil. And as for Mr. Tinka, why, the following Monday, he took Miss Evelyn to Palm Beach without so much as a word. Chapter 6. The Cruelest Month. One night in April, I was standing in the Wall Street stop of the IRT, waiting to hoi polloi home. It had been 20 minutes since the previous train, and the platform was crowded with hats and sighs and roughly folded afternoon editions. On the ground nearby was an overstuffed valise bound with string. But for the absence of children, it could have been a way station in a time of war. A man who was squeezing past me knocked my elbow. He had brown hair and a cashmere coat. Like one out of keeping with the times, he turned to apologize. And for the briefest moment, I thought it was Tinker. But I should have known better. Tinker Gray was nowhere near the Interborough Rapid Transit. At the end of their first week in Palm Beach, Eve had sent me a postcard from the Breakers Hotel where she and Tinker were holed up. "Sis, we miss you something awful," or so she wrote. And Tinker echoed the sentiment in the margin, wrapping little block letters around my address and up toward the stamp. On the picture, Eve had drawn an arrow pointing to their balcony overlooking the beach. She drew a sign stuck in the sand that read, "No jumping." The postscript read, "See you in a week." But 2 weeks later, I got a postcard from the marina at Key West. In the meantime, I took 5,000 pages of dictation. I typed 400,000 words in language as gray as the weather. I sutured split infinitives and hoisted dangling modifiers and wore out the seat of my best flannel skirt. At night, alone at my kitchen table, I ate peanut butter on toast, mastered the rough and slough, and waded into the novels of E.M. Forster just to see what all the fuss was about. In all, I saved $14.57. My father would have been proud. The gracious stranger maneuvered across the platform and took a position beside a mousy young woman who looked up at his approach and briefly met my gaze. It was Charlotte Sykes, the typing prodigy, who sat to my left. Charlotte had thick black eyebrows, but she also had delicate features and beautiful skin. She could have made a favorable impression on someone if she hadn't acted as though at any moment the city was going to step on her. Tonight, she was sporting a pillbox hat with a funereal chrysanthemum stitched to its crown. She lived somewhere on the Lower East Side, and she seemed to be taking her cue from me as to how late one should work, because she often ended up on the platform a few minutes on my heels. Charlotte took a furtive look in my direction, obviously working up the courage to approach. Lest there be any doubt, I took a room with a view from my purse and opened to Chapter 6. It is a lovely oddity of human nature that a person is more inclined to interrupt two people in conversation than one person alone with a book, even if it is a foolish romance. George had turned at the sound of her arrival. For a moment, he contemplated her as one who had fallen out of heaven. He saw radiant joy in her face. He saw the flowers beat against her dress. The beating of flowers was drowned out by the brakes of a train. The refugees on the platform gathered their possessions and readied themselves to fight for passage. I let them push their way around me. When the station was this crowded, you were generally better off waiting for the next train. Strategically positioned across the platform, rush hour conductors in little green caps acted like cops at the scene of an accident, broadening their shoulders and preparing to push people forward or back as necessary. The doors opened and the crowd surged. The blue-black chrysanthemum on Charlotte's hat bobbed ahead like flotsam on the sea. "Make room in there!" shouted the conductors, shoving high and low alike. A moment later, the train was gone, leaving a smattering of wiser folk behind. I turned the page, secure in my solitude. "Catherine!" "Charlotte." At the last minute, she must have doubled back, like a Cherokee scout. "I didn't know you took this train," she said, disingenuously. "Every day." She blushed, sensing that she'd been caught in a fib. The blush brought badly needed color to her cheeks. She should have fibbed more often. "Where do you live?" she asked. "On 11th Street." Her face brightened. "We're nearly neighbors. I live on Ludlow, a few blocks east of Bowery." "I know where Ludlow is." She smiled apologetically. "Of course." Charlotte was holding a large document with both hands in front of her waist, the way a schoolgirl holds her textbooks. From the thickness of it, you could tell it was the draft of a merger agreement or an offering plan. Whatever it was, she shouldn't have had it with her. I let the silence grow awkward, though apparently not awkward enough. "Did you grow up in the neighborhood?" she asked. "I grew up in Brighton Beach." "Jeepers," she said. She was about to ask what Brighton Beach was like or which subway ran there or if I'd ever been to Coney Island, but a train came to my rescue. There were still only a scattering of people on the platform, so the conductors ignored us. They smoked cigarettes with worldly indifference like soldiers in between assaults. Charlotte took the seat beside me. On the bench facing us, there was a middle-aged chambermaid disinclined to raise her eyes. She wore an old burgundy coat over her black-and-white uniform and a pair of practical shoes. Above her head hung a poster from the Department of Health, discouraging the practice of sneezing without a handkerchief. "How long have you worked for Miss Markham?" Charlotte asked. It was to Charlotte's credit that she said Miss Markham rather than Quiggin and Hale. "Since 1934, I said. "That must make you one of the senior girls." "Not by a long shot." We were quiet for a few seconds. I thought maybe she was finally getting the message. Instead, she launched into a monologue. Isn't Miss Markham something else? I've never met anyone like her. She's just so impressive. Did you know that she speaks French? I heard her speaking it with one of the partners. I swear, she can see the draft of a letter once and remember it word for word. Charlotte was suddenly chattering at twice her usual pace. I couldn't tell if it was nerves or an effort to say as much as possible before the train arrived at her stop. But then, all the people at Q&H are just so especially nice, even the partners. I was in Mr. Quiggin's office just the other day to get some things signed. Have you been in his office? Why, of course you have. You know how he has that fish tank just filled with fish? Well, there was this one little fish that was the most amazing shade of blue, and its nose was pressed against the glass. I couldn't take my eyes off it, even though Miss Markham tells us not to let our eyes wander around the partners' offices. But when Mr. Quiggin finished, he came right around his desk and told me the Latin names of each and every one of those fish. As Charlotte was speeding along, the chambermaid across the aisle had raised her gaze. She was staring at Charlotte and listening as if she had stood in front of such a fish tank one day not long ago, when she, too, had had delicate features and beautiful skin, when her eyes were hopeful and wide, and the world had seemed splendid and fair. The train arrived at Canal Street, and the doors opened. Charlotte was talking so fast, she didn't notice. "Isn't this your stop?" Charlotte jumped. She gave a sweet, mousy wave and disappeared. It was only when the doors closed that I saw the merger agreement on the bench beside me. Clipped to the front was a note from the desk of Thomas Harper, Esquire, with the name of a Camden and Clay attorney scrolled in Harper's prep school cursive. Presumably, he had sloughed off the delivery of this draft on Charlotte by applying a little schoolboy charm. It wouldn't have taken much. She was born to be charmed. Or intimidated. Either way, it showed a solid lack of judgment on both their parts. But if New York was a many-cogged machine, then lack of judgment was the grease that kept the gears turning smoothly for the rest of us. They'd both end up getting what they deserved one way or another. I lay the agreement back on the bench. We were still stalled at the station. On the platform, a few commuters had gathered in front of the closed doors, looking hopefully through the glass, like Mr. Quiggin's fish. I redirected my gaze across the aisle and found the chambermaid staring at me. With her doleful eyes, she looked down at the forgotten document. It wouldn't be the both of them who got what they deserved, she seemed to be saying. That charming boy, with his fine enunciation and floppy bangs, they'll let him talk his way out of it. And little Miss Wide-Eyes, she'll pay the price for the both of them. The doors opened again, and the commuters piled on board. Shit, I said. I grabbed the agreement and got an arm between the doors just before they closed.
Come on, sweet stuff, said a conductor.
Sweet your own stuff, I replied. I headed up the east side stair and began working my way toward Ludlow, looking among the wide-brimmed hats and the brill-creamed hair for a bobbing black chrysanthemum. If I didn't catch her in 5 blocks, I told myself, this agreement was going to merge with an ash can. I found her on the corner of Canal and Christie. She was standing in front of Schatz and Sons, kosher purveyors of all things pickled. She wasn't shopping. She was talking to a diminutive old woman with black eyes in a familiarly funereal dress. The old woman had this evening's locks wrapped in yesterday's news. Excuse me. Charlotte looked up. An expression of surprise turned to a girlish smile. Catherine! She gestured to the old woman at her side. This is my grandmother.
No kidding.
Nice to meet you, I said. Charlotte said something to the old lady in Yiddish, presumably explaining that we worked together. You left this on the train, I said. The smile left Charlotte's face. She took the document in hand. Oh, what an oversight! How can I thank you?
Forget it,
She paused for a second, and then gave in to that worst of compulsions.
Mr. Harper has a meeting first thing tomorrow with an important client, but this revision needs to be at Camden and Clay by 9, so he asked if on my way to the office I could...
In addition to a Harvard degree, Mr. Harper has a trust fund. Charlotte looked at me with bovine bewilderment. These will hold him in good stead, should he ever be dismissed. Charlotte's grandmother looked at my hands. Charlotte looked at my shoes. In the summer, the Schatzes rolled their barrels of pickles and herring and watermelon rind right onto the sidewalk, sloshing a vinegary brine on the paving stones. 8 months later, you could still smell it. The old woman said something to Charlotte.
My grandmother is asking if you would join us for dinner.
I'm afraid I'm previously committed. Charlotte translated unnecessarily. From Canal Street, I still had 15 blocks to go, which was about 10 too short to warrant another subway fare. So, in the language of the neighborhood, I schlepped. At every intersection, I looked to my left and right. Hester Street, Grand Street, Broome Street, Spring, Prince Street, First Street, Second Street, Third. Each block looked like a dead end from a different country. Tucked among the tenements, you could see the shops of other fathers and sons selling the reformulated fare of their home countries, their sausages or cheeses, their smoked or salted fish wrapped in Italian or Ukrainian newsprint to be trundled home by their own unvanquishable grandmothers. Looking up, you could see the rows of two-room flats where three generations gathered nightly for a supper bracketed by religious devotions as saccharine and peculiar as their after-dinner liqueurs. If Broadway was a river running from the top of Manhattan down to the Battery, undulating with traffic and commerce and lights, then the east-west streets were eddies where, leaf-like, one could turn slow circles from the beginning to the ever-shall-be, world without end. At Astor Place, I stopped to buy the evening edition of The Times at a curbside newsstand. The front page offered a modified map of Europe, graced with a gentle dotted line to reflect a shifting frontier. The old man behind the counter had the white overgrown eyebrows and kind-hearted expression of an absent-minded country uncle. It made you wonder what he was doing there.
"Nice night," he said, presumably referencing what little he could see of it reflected in the milliner's window.
"Yes, it is."
"Do you think it'll rain?"
I looked over the east side rooftops, where the evening star shone as clear as the beacon of a plane. "No," I said, "not tonight." He smiled and looked relieved. As I handed him a dollar, another customer approached and stopped a foot closer to me than was necessary. Before I had a chance to take him in, I noticed the newsman's eyebrows droop.
"Hey, sister," the customer said, "you have a smoke or something?"
I turned and met his gaze. Well on his way from unemployed to unemployable, his hair was much longer now, and he had a poorly groomed goatee. But he had the same presumptuous smile and the wandering eye that he had had when we were 14.
"No," I said, "sorry."
He gave a shake. Then he tilted his head.
"Hey, I know you, right?"
"I don't think so."
"Sure," he said, "I know you. Room 214, Sister Sally Salamone. I before E, except after C."
He laughed at the thought of it. "You've mistaken me for somebody else," I said.
"I ain't mistaken," he said, "and you ain't somebody else."
"Here," I said, holding out my change. He held up both hands in mild protest.
"I couldn't presuppose."
Then he laughed at his own word choice and walked off towards Second Avenue. "That's the problem with being born in New York," the old newsman observed a little sadly.
"You've got no New York to run away to."
Chapter 7. The Lonesome Chandeliers.
This is Katie Content.
This is Clarence Darrow.
The typewriters at Quicken and Hale steamed full speed ahead, but not so loudly that I couldn't hear the lilt back in Evie's voice.
When did you get in town, Miss Darrow?
67 hours ago.
How is Key West?
Droll.
No need for jealousy on my end?
Not a smidgen. Listen, we're having a few friends over tonight. We'd love it if you'd round out the table. Can we lure you away?
From what?
That's the spirit.
I arrived at the Beresford 40 minutes late. As embarrassing as it is to admit, I was late because I was having trouble deciding what to wear. When Eve and I lived at the boarding house, we shared our wardrobe with the other girls on the floor, and we always looked smart on Saturday night. But when I moved out, I had something of a rude awakening. I discovered that all the fun clothes had been theirs. I apparently owned all the frumpy utilitarian numbers. Scanning my closet, the clothes looked as drab as the sheets outside my window. I settled on a navy blue dress that was 4 years out of date and spent half an hour with a sewing kit, shortening the hem. Manning the elevator was a big-shouldered sort whom I didn't recognize.
"Hamilton isn't on tonight?" I asked as we ascended.
"That boy's gone."
"That's too bad."
"Not for me, it ain't. I wouldn't have no job if he still had it."
This time, it was Eve waiting for me in the foyer.
"Katie!"
We kissed each other on the right cheeks, and she took both of my hands in hers, just as Tinker liked to do. She stepped back and looked me over, as if I was the one just returned from 2 months at the beach.
"You look great," she said.
"You're kidding, right? You look great. I look like Moby Dick."
Evie squinted and smiled. And she did look great. In Florida, her hair had turned flaxen, and she had cut it back to her jaw, accentuating the fineness of her features. The sardonic lethargy of March had been exorcised, and a teasing glint had returned to her eye. She was also wearing a spectacular pair of diamond chandeliers. They cascaded from her earlobes to her neck and sparkled over the evenly tanned surface of her skin. There was no question about it. Tinker's Palm Beach prescription had been spot on. Eve led the way into the living room. Tinker was standing beside one of the couches talking with another man about shares in a railroad. Eve interrupted him by taking his hand.
"Look who's here," she said.
He was looking good, too. While in Florida, he had lost his nursemaid pounds and his hangdog demeanor. He had taken to entertaining without a tie, and his tanned sternum showed through his open collar. Without quite letting go of Evie's hand, he leaned forward and gave me a peck on the cheek. If he pecked to make a point, he needn't have. I had already gotten the lay of the land. No one seemed particularly put out that I was late, but the price I paid was missing the drinks. About a minute after I was introduced, I was ushered into the dining room empty-handed. From the looks of the crowd, I had missed more than a round. There were three other guests. Sitting to my left was the man that Tinker had been speaking to when I'd arrived, a stockbroker nicknamed Bucky, who summered near Tinker as a boy. In the relapse of 37, apparently Bucky had had the good sense to cash out before his clients. Now he lived comfortably in Greenwich, Connecticut. He was a fine-looking charmer who, while nowhere near as smart as he sounded, was at least of better cheer than his wife. With her hair pulled back, Wiss, short for Wisteria, seemed as prim and miserable as a schoolmarm. The state of Connecticut is one of our nation's smallest, but it wasn't small enough for her. In the afternoon, she probably climbed her colonial stair and looked out her second-story window toward Delaware with a bitter, envious gaze. Seated directly across from me was a friend of Tinker's named Wallace Wolcott. Wallace, who had been a few years ahead of Tinker at St. George's, had the fair hair and solemn grace of a collegiate tennis star who never quite cared for the sport. For a moment, I wondered whether it was Eve's or Tinker's idea to invite him on my behalf. Maybe it was a shared plan, the sort of transparent conspiracy that good marriages are made of. Whose ever idea, it was a misfire. Wallace, who had a slight speech impediment, a sort of dead stop in the middle of every remark, was obviously more interested in playing with his spoon than making eyes at me. All in all, one got the sense he'd rather be behind his desk at the family paper concern. The party was suddenly talking about ducks. On the way back to New York, the five of them had stopped over in South Carolina at the Wolcott's hunting plantation, and they were debating the finer points of mallard plumage. I let my mind wander until I became conscious that someone was asking me something. It was Bucky. "What's that?" I asked. "Have you ever been hunting down south, Katie?" "I've never been hunting in any direction."
"It's a good sport. You should join us next year."
I turned to Wallace. "Do you shoot there every year?"
"Most years. A few weekends in the fall and spring."
"Then why do the ducks come back?" Everyone laughed but Wiss. She clarified on my behalf.
"They grow a field of corn and flood it. That's what attracts the birds. So in that sense, it's actually not that sporting."
"Well, isn't that the way that Bucky attracted you?" For a moment, everyone laughed but Wiss. Then Wiss started laughing, and everyone laughed but Bucky. The soup was served. It was black bean with a spoonful of sherry. Maybe it was the sherry that Tinker and I had shared. If so, it was poetic justice for someone, but it was too soon to tell for whom.
"This is delicious," Tinker said to Eve, his first words in half an hour. "What is it?"
"Black bean and sherry. And don't worry, there's not a spot of cream in it."
Tinker gave an embarrassed smile.
"Tinker's been minding his nutrition," Eve explained.
"It's working," I said. "You look terrific."
"I doubt that," he said.
"No," Eve said, raising her glass to Tinker. "Katie's right. You're positively glowing."
"That's because he shaves twice a day," said Bucky.
"No," said Wallace.
"It's the exercise."
Eve pointed a finger at Wallace in agreement.
"In the Keys," she explained, "there was an island a mile off the coast, and Tinker would swim there and back twice a day."
"He was a
fish."
"That's nothing," Bucky said. "One summer he swam across the Narragansett Bay."
The star-like blushes on Tinker's cheeks grew a shade redder.
"It's only a few miles," he said. "It's not hard if you time the tides right." "How about you, Katie?" Bucky asked, taking another stab at it. "Do you enjoy a good swim?"
"I don't know how." Everyone sat up in their seats.
"What's that?"
"You don't know how to swim?"
"Not a stroke." "Then what?"
"I sink, I suppose. Like most things."
"Did you grow up in Kansas?" asked Wiss without irony.
"I grew up in Brighton Beach." More excitement.
"Splendid,"
said Bucky, as if I'd climbed the Matterhorn.
"Don't you want to learn?" asked Wiss.
"I don't know how to shoot, either. Between the two, I'd rather learn to shoot." Laughter.
"Well, that's well within your grasp," Bucky encouraged. "There's really nothing to it."
"Obviously, I know how to pull a trigger," I said. "What I want to learn is how to hit a bullseye."
"I'll teach you," said Bucky.
"No," said Tinker, looking more at ease with the shift of attention. "Wallace is your man." Wallace had been drawing a circle on the linen with the tip of his dessert spoon. "Is that right, Wallace?"
"Hardly."
"I've seen him shoot the center of a target at 100 yards, Tinker said. I raised my eyebrows. "True or false?"
"True,"
he said shyly.
"But to be fair, a bullseye doesn't move."
When the bowls were cleared, I excused myself to go to the bathroom. A nice burgundy had been served with the soup, and my head was beginning to turn on its spindle. There was a little washroom near the living room, but thumbing my nose at etiquette, I went down the hall to the master bath. From a quick look around the bedroom, I could see that Eve was no longer sleeping alone. I peed and flushed. Then, as I was standing at the sink washing my hands, Eve appeared. She winked at me in the mirror. She hoisted up her dress and sat on the toilet, just like old times. It made me regret having wanted to snoop.
"So," she said coyly, "what do you think about Wallace?"
"He seems grade A.
And then some."
She flushed and pulled up her hose. She came over and took my place at the sink. There was a small ceramic cigarette box on the vanity. I lit one and sat on the john to smoke. I watched as she washed her hands. From where I was sitting, you could see her scar. It still looked red and a little inflamed, but it wasn't getting much in her way anymore.
"Those are some earrings," I said.
She appreciated herself in the mirror.
"Aren't they, though?"
"Tinker's treating you right."
She lit her own cigarette and tossed the match over her shoulder. Then she leaned against the wall, took a drag, and smiled.
"He didn't give them to me."
"Then who?"
"I found them, in the bedside table."
"Gadzooks."
She took a drag and nodded with her eyebrows raised.
"Those have got to be worth over $10,000, I said.
"And then some."
"What were they doing there?"
"No good to anyone."
I spread my legs and dropped my cigarette in the bowl.
"But here's the best part," she said. "I've worn them every day since we got back from Palm Beach, and he hasn't uttered the peep of a sheep."
I laughed. It was a great old Evie sort of thing to say.
"Well, I guess they're yours now."
She tamped out her cigarette in the basin of her sink.
"You better believe it, sis."
Two more bottles of Burgundy were poured with the main course. They may as well have been poured over our heads. I don't think anyone tasted the tenderloin, or the lamb, or whatever it was. Bucky, good and drunk, launched into a yarn for my benefit about how the five of them had gone to a casino in Tampa, St. Pete. After they'd spent 15 minutes around a roulette table, it became pretty clear that none of the boys intended to place a bet. Presumably, they were afraid to lose the money that wasn't theirs in the first place. So to teach them a lesson, Eve borrowed $100 from each and scattered chips across even, black, and her birthday. When 9 red came up, she paid back the principal right there on the spot and stuffed the winnings in her brassiere. When it comes to gambling, some feel nauseated when they win, and others feel nauseated when they lose. Eve had a good stomach for both.
"Bucky, dear," his wife warned, "you're slurring your words."
"Slurring is the cursive of speech," I observed.
"Exactly," he said, elbowing me in the ribs.
Coffee in the living room was announced just in time. Keeping an earlier promise, Eve took Wisteria on a tour of the apartment while Bucky cornered Wallace to secure a hunting invitation for the fall. So Tinker and I ended up in the living room, alone. He sat down on one of the couches and I sat beside him. He put his elbows on his knees and clasped his hands. He looked back at the dining room as if he was hoping that a seventh guest would miraculously appear. He took his lighter from his pocket. He snapped the lid open and shut, and then put it away again.
"It's good of you to come," he said at last.
"It's a dinner party, Tinker, not a crisis."
"She looks better, doesn't she?"
"She looks great. I told you she'd be fine." He smiled and nodded. Then he looked me in the eye, maybe for the first time all evening.
"The thing of it is, Katie, Eve and I are sort of making a go of it."
"I know, Tinker."
"I don't think we really set out."
"I think it's great."
"Really?"
"Absolutely." A neutral observer would probably have raised an eyebrow at my answer. There wasn't much jingle in my delivery, and one-word responses just have that way of not sounding very convincing. But the thing of it is, I meant it. Every one word of it. For starters, you could hardly blame them. Balmy breezes, turquoise seas, Caribbean rum. These are well-established aphrodisiacs. But so, too, are proximity and necessity and the threat of despair. If, as was painfully apparent in March, Tinker and Eve had both lost something essential of themselves in that car crash, in Florida, they had helped each other gain a bit of it back. One of Newton's laws of physics is something about how bodies in motion will hew to their trajectory unless they meet an external force. I suppose, given the nature of the world, it was perfectly likely that some such force could present itself to set Tinker and Eve off their current course. But there was no way it was going to be me. Bucky came stumbling into the room and collapsed in a chair. Even I was relieved to see him. Tinker took the opportunity to go over to the bar. When he came back with drinks that no one needed, he took a seat on the other couch. Bucky took a grateful swig and then vaulted back into the topic of railroad shares.
"So you think it's in the realm, Tink, that we could get a piece of this Asheville rail business?"
"I don't see why not," Tink conceded, "if it's the right thing for your clients."
"How about I come down to 40 Wall and we hash it out over lunch?"
"Sure."
"This week?"
"Oh, leave him alone, Bucky." Wisteria had just come back with Eve.
"Don't be such a bore," she said. "Come on, Wis. He doesn't mind mixing a little business with pleasure, do you, Tink?"
"Of course not," said Tink, politely.
"You see? Besides, he's got the whole concession. The world has no choice but to beat a path to his door."
Wis glowered.
"Evelyn,"
Wallace interrupted adeptly,
"dinner was delicious." "Hear, hear," was the chorus.
For the next few minutes, there was a thorough rehashing of the courses. That meat was delicious, the sauce was perfect, and ooh, that chocolate mousse. This was a social nicety that seemed more prevalent the higher you climbed the social ladder and the less your hostess cooked. Eve accepted the compliments with appropriate panache and a dismissive wave of the hand. When the clock struck one, we were all in the foyer. Eve and Tinker had their fingers intertwined, as much to shore each other up as to show affection.
"Lovely evening. Terrific time. Must do it again."
Even Wis was encouraging an encore. God knows why. When the elevator came, it was the same man who had taken me up earlier.
"Ground floor,"
he announced once he'd pulled the caging shut, as if he had formerly worked in a department store.
"That's quite an apartment," Wis remarked to Bucky.
"Like a phoenix from the ashes," he replied.
"How much do you think it cost?"
No one answered her. Wallace was either too well raised or too disinterested. Bucky was too busy trying to bump his shoulder into mine unintentionally. I was too busy wondering, when I received the invitation to the reprise, what reason I could give for not being able to attend. And yet, when I was lying in bed later that night, alone and alert, with the corridors of my walk-up unusually quiet, the person foremost on my mind was Eve. For in the years preceding, if I had chanced onto the guest list of a dinner party like this one with all its temperate discord and stayed out much too late for a school night, my one consolation would have been finding Eve propped on her pillows, waiting to hear every last detail. Chapter 8. Abandon Every Hope. One night in mid-May, as I was crossing 7th Street on my way home, a woman my age came around the corner and knocked me off my heels.
"Watch where you're going," she said.
Then she leaned over me to get a closer look.
"Bust my bosoms, is that you, Content?"
It was Fran Pacelli, the plum-chested City College dropout from down the hall at Mrs. Martingale's. I didn't know Fran that well, but she seemed a good enough sort. She liked to unsettle the prim at the boarding house by wandering the halls without a shirt on and asking loudly if they had any extra booze. One night I'd caught her climbing through a second-story window, wearing nothing but high-heel shoes and a Dodgers uniform. Her father was in trucking, which in those days usually meant that he had run liquor in the 20s. From Fran's vocabulary, you might have suspected that she'd run a little liquor in the 20s, too.
"What a lucky break," she said, pulling me to my feet, "bumping into you like this. You look great."
"Thanks," I said, brushing off my skirt. Fran looked around the street as if she was thinking something through.
Where you headed? How about a drink? You look like you could use one."
"I thought you said I looked great."
"Sure."
She pointed back up 7th Street.
"I know a cute little place right up here. I'll buy you a beer. We'll catch up. It'll be a gas."
The cute little place turned out to be an old Irish bar. Over the front door, a sign read, "Good ale, raw onions, no ladies." "I think that means us."
"Come on," Fran said. "Don't be such a patsy."
Inside, the air was loud and smelled of spilled beer. Along the bar, the front lines of the Easter uprising sat shoulder to shoulder, eating hard-boiled eggs and drinking stout. The floor was covered with sawdust, and the tin ceiling was stained with the gaslight smoke of decades past. Most of the customers ignored us. The bartender gave us a sour look, but didn't throw us out. Fran took in the crowd with a glance. There were a few tables in the front that were empty, but she shoved her way through the drinkers with a couple of, "Excuse me, mates." In the back, there was a cluttered little room hung with grainy photos of the Tammany crews, the boys who rounded up votes with billy clubs and cash. Without a word, Fran began moving toward the opposite corner. At the table nearest the coal stove, 3 young men sat huddled over their beer. One of them, a tall, thin redhead, was wearing a jumpsuit with the words "Pacelli Trucking" stitched on the breast in a perversely feminine script. I was beginning to get the picture. As we approached, you could hear the 3 of them arguing above the din, or rather, you could hear one of them, the belligerent one, with his back to us.
"Second of all," he was saying to the redhead, "he's a fucking hack."
"A hack?"
The redhead smiled, enjoying the tussle.
"That's right. He's got stamina, but he's got no finesse, no discipline."
The small man in between the combatants shifted in his seat uneasily. You could tell he was congenitally unsettled by confrontation, but he looked back and forth as if he couldn't afford to miss a word.
"Third of all," the belligerent one continued, "he's more overrated than Joe Lewis."
"Right, Hank."
"Fourth of all, fuck you."
"Fuck me?"
the redhead asked.
"In what orifice?"
As Hank started to clarify, the redhead noticed us and gave a toothy grin.
"Peaches, what are you doing here?"
"Grub?"
Fran exclaimed in disbelief.
"Well, I'll be damned. My friend Katie and I were in the neighborhood and just stopped in for a beer."
"What are the chances?"
said Grub. "What are the chances? How about 100%?
"Why don't you join us?" he said. "This is Hank, this is Johnny."
Grub pulled a chair up at his side, and hapless Johnny pulled up another. Hank didn't budge. He looked more inclined to throw us out than the bartender had. "Fran," I said, "I think I'll mosey along."
"Oh, come on, Katie, have a beer. Then we'll mosey together."
She didn't wait for an answer. She went over to Grub, leaving me the seat next to Hank. Grub poured beer from a pitcher into 2 glasses that looked like they'd already been used.
"Do you live around here?"
Fran asked Grub.
"Do you mind?" Hank said to Fran. "We're in the middle of something."
"Oh, come on, Hank, let it go."
"Let it go where?"
"Hank, I get you think that he's a hack, but he's the fucking precursor to cubism."
"Who says?"
"Picasso says."
"I'm sorry," I said. "Are you guys arguing about Cézanne?" Hank looked at me sourly.
"Who the fuck do you think we're arguing about?"
"I thought you were arguing about boxing."
"That was an analogy," Hank said, dismissively.
"Hank and Grub are painters," Johnny said. Fran squirmed with pleasure and gave me a wink.
"But Hank," Johnny ventured cautiously, "don't you think those landscapes are nice? I mean the green and brown ones?"
"No,"
he said. "There's no accounting for taste," I said to Johnny. Hank looked at me again, but more carefully. I couldn't tell if he was getting ready to contradict or hit me. Maybe he wasn't sure either. Before we found out, Grubb called to a man in the doorway.
Hey, Mark.
Hey, Grubb.
You know these guys, right? Johnny Jerkins, Hank Gray?
The men nodded to each other soberly. No one bothered introducing us girls. Mark sat down at a nearby table and Grubb joined him. I barely noticed when Fran followed, leaving me to fend for myself. I was too busy looking at Hank Gray. Unwavering Henry Gray. Older, shorter. He looked just like Tinker after 2 weeks without food and a lifetime without manners.
Have you seen his paintings?
Johnny said, gesturing surreptitiously toward Mark. Grubb says they're a mess.
He's wrong about that, too, Hank said, mournfully.
What do you paint? I asked. He considered me for a moment, trying to decide whether I deserved a reply.
Real things, he said finally. Things of beauty.
Still lifes?
I don't paint bowls of oranges, if that's what you mean.
Can't bowls of oranges be things of beauty?
Not anymore, they can't.
He reached across the table and picked up the box of Lucky Strikes that was sitting in front of Johnny.
This is a thing of beauty,
he said.
The boat hole red and howitzer green, the concentric circles. These are colors with purpose, shapes with purpose.
He took one of the cigarettes from Johnny's pack without saying please. Hank painted that, Johnny said, pointing toward a canvas that was leaning against the coal scuttle. You could tell from Johnny's voice that he admired Hank, and not just as an artist. He seemed impressed with the whole program, as if Hank was carving out an important new persona for the American male. But it wasn't hard to see where Hank was coming from. There was a new generation of painters trying to take Hemingway's ethos of the bullring and apply it to canvas, or if not to canvas, then at least to innocent bystanders. They were gloomy, arrogant, brutish, and most importantly, they were unafraid of death, whatever that means for a guy who spends his days in front of an easel. I doubt Johnny had any idea how fashionable Hank's attitude was becoming, or what sort of Brahmin bank account was propping up the rough indifference. The painting, which was obviously by the same person who had painted the assembly of longshoremen in Tinker's apartment, showed the loading dock of a butchery. In the foreground were trucks parked in a row, and in the background loomed a large neon sign in the shape of a steer that read Vitelli's. While figurative, the colors and lines of the painting had been simplified in the style of Stuart Davis. Very much in the style of Stuart Davis.
Gansevoort Street? I asked.
That's right, said Hank, a little impressed.
Why did you decide to paint Vitelli's?
Because he lives there, said Johnny.
Because I couldn't get it out of my mind, corrected Hank. Neon signs are like sirens. You've got to tie yourself to the mast if you're going to paint them. You know what I mean?
Not really. I looked at the picture. But I like it, I said. He winced.
It's not a decoration, sister. It's the world.
Cézanne painted the world.
All those fruits and ewers and drowsy dames, that wasn't the world. That was a bunch of guys wishing they were painters to the king.
I'm sorry, but I'm pretty sure the painters who curried favor did history paintings and portraits. Still lifes were a more personal form. Hank stared at me for a moment.
Who sent you here?
What?
Were you the president of your debating society or something? All that may have been true 100 years ago or whatever, but after being soaked in admiration, one generation's genius is another's VD. Have you ever worked in a kitchen?
Sure.
Really? At summer camp? The dorm dining hall? Listen, in the army, if you draw KP, you might chop 100 onions in half an hour. The oil gets so deep in your fingertips, for weeks you can smell it every time you take a shower. That's what Cézanne's oranges are now, and his landscapes, too. The stink of onion in your fingertips, okay?
Okay.
Yeah, okay.
I looked over at Fran, thinking maybe it was time to go, but she had moved onto Grubb's lap. Like most belligerent people, Hank was getting tiresome fast, so I had good reason to call it a night. But I couldn't stop wondering about Tinker's instincts. I mean, how should I take it that he thought Hank and I would hit it off? I decided to take it badly. So I gather you're Tinker's brother. I definitely knocked him off the rails with that one. You could tell it was a sensation he hadn't much experience with and didn't much like.
How do you know Tinker?
We're friends.
Really?
Is that surprising?
Well, he was never much for this sort of back and forth.
Maybe he's got better things to do.
Oh, he's got better things to do, all right. And maybe he'd get around to doing them, if it weren't for that manipulative cunt.
She's a friend of mine, too.
No accounting for taste, right?
Hank reached over for another one of Johnny's cigarettes. Where did this hack get off running down Evelyn Ross? I thought to myself. Let's throw him through a windshield and see how he holds up. I couldn't resist observing. Didn't Stuart Davis paint a pack of lucky strikes?
I don't know. Did he?
Sure he did. Come to think of it, your paintings remind me a lot of his. What with the urban commercial imagery and primary colors and simplified lines.
Nice. You should dissect frogs for a living.
I've done that, too. Doesn't your brother have some Stuart Davises in his apartment?
Do you think Teddy knows the least thing about Stuart Davis? Fuck. He would have bought a tin drum if I told him to.
Your brother doesn't seem to think so poorly of you.
Yeah? Maybe he should.
I bet you drew a lot of KP. Hank laughed until he coughed. He picked up his glass and tilted it at me with his first smile of the evening.
You got that right, sister.
When we all stood to go, it was Hank who covered the check. He took some wadded bills out of his pocket and tossed them on the table like they were candy wrappers. What about their colors and shapes? I wanted to ask. Didn't they have purpose? Weren't they things of beauty? If only his trust officer could see him now. After the drink at that Irish bar, I figured I'd seen the last of Fran. But she got hold of my number and called one rainy Saturday. She apologized for having ditched me and said she wanted to make it up by treating me to the movies. She took me to a string of bars instead, and we had a gay old time. When I got around to asking why she had bothered to track me down, she said it was because we were so simpatico. We were about the same height, with the same chestnut coloring, and we were both raised in two-room apartments across a river from Manhattan. I guess on a rainy Saturday afternoon, that was simpatico enough. So we trooped around a bit, and then one night in early June, she called to see if I wanted to go to the runarounds at Belmont. My father abhorred wagering of any kind. He thought it the surest route to relying on the kindness of strangers. So I had never played penny a point canasta or bet a stick of gum on who could throw the first rock through the principal's window. I certainly had never been to a racetrack. I didn't know what she was talking about. The runarounds? Apparently, on the Wednesday before the Belmont Stakes, the track was open to the horses on the card so that the jockeys could give them a feel for the course. Fran said it was much more exciting than the race itself, a claim so unlikely that the runarounds seemed certain to be a bore. Sorry, I said. On Wednesdays, I happen to work. That's the beauty of it. They open the track at daybreak so each of the horses can get a run in before it gets hot. We zip out on the train, watch a few ponies, and still punch the clock by 9. Trust me, I've done it a million times. When Fran said that they opened the track at daybreak, I imagined this was a figure of speech, and we would be heading out to Long Island sometime after 6. But it was no figure of speech. And this being early June, daybreak was closer to 5. So she came knocking at 4:30 with her hair coiled in a tower on the top of her head. We had to wait 15 minutes for a train. It rattled into the station like it was coming from another century. The interior lights cast a half-hearted glow over the nocturnal flotsam in its care, the janitors, drunkards, and dance hall girls. When we got to Belmont, The sun was just beginning to heft its way over the horizon as if it needed to defy gravity to do so. Fran was defying gravity, too. She was perky, bright, annoying.
"Come on, Patsy," she said. "Hustle your bustle."
The sprawling race day parking lot was empty. As we crossed it, I could see Fran carefully scrutinizing the edifice of the track.
"Over here,"
she said, without much confidence, heading toward the service gates. I pointed toward the sign that said entrance. "How about over here?"
"Sure."
"Wait a second, Fran. Let me ask you something. Have you ever been here before? I mean, ever once?"
"Sure. Hundreds of times."
"Let me ask you something else. When you're speaking, are you ever not lying?" "Was that a double negative? I'm not too good with those.
Now let me ask you something."
She pointed at her blouse.
"Does this look good on me?"
Before I could answer, she tugged on her neckline to expose a little more cleavage. At the main gate, we passed the unmanned ticket booths, pushed through the turnstiles, and headed up a narrow ramp into the open air. The stadium was eerie and still. A green mist hung over the track like you'd expect to see over the surface of a pond in New England. Scattered across the empty stands, the other early risers were huddled in groups of 2 to 4. It seemed unseasonably cold for June. A few feet from us, a man in a quilted jacket was holding a cup of coffee. "You didn't tell me it was going to be so cold," I said.
"You know what June is like."
"Not at 5 a.m., I don't. Everybody else has coffee," I added. She slugged me in the shoulder.
"What a whiner you are."
Fran was scrutinizing again, this time the people in the middle of the stands. Off to our right, a tall, thin man in a plaid shirt stood and waved. It was Grubb in the company of hapless Johnny. When we got to Grubb's seat, he put his arm around Fran and looked at me.
"It's Catherine, right?"
I was vaguely impressed that he knew my name.
"She's cold," Fran said, "and mad she doesn't have coffee."
Grubb grinned. From inside a knapsack, he produced a lap blanket that he tossed to me, a thermos that he handed to Fran, and then, like a hack magician, he felt elaborately around the bag until he brought out a cinnamon donut perched upright on his fingertips, which, as it turns out, is all it takes to secure a place in my affections. Fran poured me a cup of coffee. I hunched over it with the blanket on my shoulders like a Civil War soldier. Having come to the track with his parents when he was in shorts, the whole excursion to the runarounds was like a return to summer camp for Grubb, full of sweet nostalgia and youthful fun. He quickly gave us a lay of the land. The size of the track, the qualifying horses, the importance of Belmont versus Saratoga. Then, lowering his voice, he pointed toward the paddock.
"Here comes the first horse."
On cue, the motley assembly rose. The jockey wasn't wearing one of those brightly colored checkered outfits that helps the track pretend it's festive. He was wearing a brown jumpsuit like a diminutive garage mechanic. As he walked the horse from the paddock out into the track, steam rose from the horse's nostrils. In the stillness, you could hear it whinny from 500 feet. The jockey talked briefly to a man with a pipe, presumably the trainer, and then swung onto the horse's back. He cantered a little so that the horse could take in its surroundings, circled and positioned for a start. A hush fell. Without the shot of a gun, horse and rider took off. The sound of the horse's hooves drifted up into the stands in muffled rhythm as clods of turf were kicked in the air. The jockey seemed to take the first lengths at an easy pace, holding his head about a foot above the horse's. But at the second turn, he urged the animal on. He drew his elbows inward and squeezed his thighs around the horse's barrel. He tucked the side of his face against its neck so that he could whisper encouragements. The horse responded. Though it was getting farther away, you could tell it was running faster, thrusting its muzzle forward and drumming the ground with rhythmic precision. It turned the far corner, and the beat of its hooves grew closer, louder, faster, until it bolted through the imaginary finish line.
"That's pasteurized," Grubb said, "the favorite."
I looked around the stands. There were no cheers, no applause. The onlookers, most of them men, offered the favorite silent recognition. They reviewed the time on their stopwatches and quietly conferred. A few shook their heads in appreciation or disappointment. I couldn't tell which. And then, pasteurized, was cantered off the track to make way for Cravat. By the third horse, I was getting a feel for the runarounds. I could see why Grubb thought them more exciting than the stakes. Though the stands were occupied by only a few hundred people instead of 50,000, to a man they were aficionados. Huddled at the rail, the innermost circle of the stadium, were the gamblers with unkempt hair who, in refining their systems, had lost it all, their savings, their homes, their families. With fevered eyes and rumpled jackets, looking like they'd slept under the stands, these inveterates leaned on the rail and watched the horses with an occasional licking of the lips. In the lower stands sat the men and women raised on racing as a great entertainment. They were the same sort you'd find in the bleachers at Dodger Stadium, the sort who knew the names of the players and all the relevant statistics. They were men and women who, like Grubb, had been brought to the track as children, and who one day would bring their children, with a sense of loyalty to an idea that they might only otherwise display in a time of war. They had picnic baskets and racing sheets, and formed fast friendships with whomever they happened to sit. In the boxes above them sat the owners and the company of young women and other hangers-on. All of the owners were rich, of course, but the ones who came to the runarounds weren't the blue bloods or the dilettantes. They were the men who had earned every penny. One silver-haired magnate in a perfectly tailored suit leaned against the rail with both arms like an admiral at the helm. You could just tell that for him, racing horses was no idle matter. It wasn't money in search of a distraction. It required all the discipline, commitment, and attention of running a railroad. And above them all, above the gamblers and the fans and the millionaires, high in the thinner air of the upper stands, were the aged trainers, the ones past their prime. They sat watching the horses with the naked eye, without binoculars or stopwatches, having no need for either. They were measuring not just the speed of the horses, not just their start or their endurance, but their courage and carelessness, too. Knowing as precisely as one can what was going to happen come Saturday without it ever occurring to them to place a bet and improve their meager lot. The one thing for certain at Belmont was that on Wednesday at 5 a.m. there was no place for the common man. This was like the circles of Dante's Inferno, populated with men of varied sins, but also with the shrewdness and devotion of the damned. It was a living reminder of why no one bothers to read Paradiso. My father hated wagering, but he would have loved the runarounds. "Come on, Peaches," Grubb said, taking her arm. "I see some old friends." Grinning with outsized pride, Peaches handed me her binoculars. As they walked away, Johnny looked up hopefully. I ditched him, saying I wanted a closer look at the paddock. When I got there, I turned Fran's binoculars back on the silver-haired admiral. There were two women in his box, gossiping and drinking from aluminum cups. The absence of steam suggested that the cups were filled with liquor. One of them offered him a sip. He didn't deign a reply. He turned instead to confer with a young man who held a stopwatch and clipboard. "You've got good taste." I turned to find Tinker's godmother at my side. I was surprised that she had recognized me, maybe a little flattered. "That's Jake DeRocher," she said. "He's worth about $50 million and self-made. I can introduce you if you'd like." I laughed. "I think I'd be a little out of my depth." "Probably," she conceded. She was dressed in tan pants and a white shirt. Her sleeves were rolled up to the elbows. She obviously wasn't cold. It made me feel self-conscious about having the blanket over my shoulders. I tried to shed it casually. "Do you have a horse in the race?" I asked. "No, but an old friend of mine owns Pasteurized." "Naturally," That's exciting, I said.
Actually, the favorite rarely is. It's the long shots that are exciting.
But I suppose it can't hurt your bank account if you own the favorite.
Perhaps, but in general, investments that need their own food and shelter don't amount to much.
Tinker had implied at some point that Mrs. Grandin's money had originally come from coal mines. Somehow that added up. She had a self-possession that could only be secured by the more immutable assets, like land and oil and gold. The next horse was on the track. "Who's that?" I asked.
"May I?"
She held her hand out for my binoculars. Her hair was barretted back so there was no need to clear it from her face. She lifted the binoculars to her eyes like a hunter, turning the lenses directly on the horse, having no problem finding her mark.
"It's Jolly Tar, the Witherings horse. Barry owns the paper in Louisville."
She lowered the binoculars but didn't hand them back. She looked at me for a moment and hesitated, the way some will when about to ask a sensitive question. Instead, she made a statement.
"I gather that Tinker and your friend are getting along. How long have they been living together? Is it 8 months now?"
"Closer to 5."
"Ah.
Do you disapprove?"
"Certainly not in the Victorian sense. I have no illusions about the liberties of our times. In fact, if pressed, I would celebrate most of them."
"You said you didn't disapprove in the Victorian sense. Does that mean you disapprove in a different sense?" She smiled.
"I need to remind myself that you work at a law firm, Catherine."
How did she know that? I wondered. "If I disapprove," she continued after weighing the question, "it's actually on your friend's behalf. I don't see any advantage to her living with Tinker. In my day, a girl's opportunities were rather limited, so the sooner she secured an eligible husband, the better. But today," she gestured toward DeRocher's box, "you see that 30-year-old blonde next to Jake? That's his fiancée, Carrie Clabbard. Carrie moved all manner of heaven and earth to get into that chair. And soon she will happily oversee scullery maids and table settings and the reupholstering of antique chairs at 3 different houses, which is all well and good. But if I were your age, I wouldn't be trying to figure out how to get into Carrie's shoes. I'd be trying to figure out how to get into Jake's." As Jolly Tar rounded the far turn, the next horse was ushered from the stables. We both looked down at the paddock. Anne didn't bother lifting the binoculars. "Gentle Savage at 50-1, she said. "Now there's your excitement." Chapter 9. The Scimitar, the Sifter, and the Wooden Leg. When I came out of work on June 9th, there was a brown Bentley parked at the curb. No matter how much you think of yourself, no matter how long you've lived in Hollywood or Hyde Park, a brown Bentley is going to catch your eye. There couldn't be more than a few hundred of them in the world, and every aspect is designed with envy in mind. The fenders rise over the wheels and drop to the running boards in the wide, lazy curve of an odalisk at rest, while the white walls of the tires look as improbably spotless as the spats on Fred Astaire. You can just tell that whoever is sitting in the back seat has the wherewithal to grant your wishes in threes. This particular brown Bentley was the model in which the chauffeur rides in the open air. He looked like an Irish cop turned manservant. He was staring straight ahead and holding the wheel with big mitts stuffed into little gray gloves. The windows of the passenger compartment were tinted so that you couldn't see who was inside. As I watched the reflection of the masses drifting by, the window rolled down.
"Shiver me timbers," I said.
"Hey, sis, where you headed?"
"I was just thinking of going down to the Battery to throw myself off the pier."
"Can it wait?" The chauffeur was suddenly at my side. He opened the rear door with surprising grace and adopted the posture of a midshipman at the head of a gangplank. Eve scooched across the seat. I saluted and climbed aboard. The air in the car was sweet with the smell of leather and the hint of a new perfume. There was so much legroom that I almost slipped off the seat onto the floor. What does this rig turn into at midnight? I asked.
An artichoke.
I hate artichokes.
I used to, too, but they grow on you.
Eve leaned forward to push an ivory button on a chrome panel.
Michael?
The chauffeur didn't turn his head. His voice crackled through the speaker as if he were 100 miles at sea.
Yes, Miss Ross? Could you take us to the Explorers Club?
Of course, Miss Ross.
Evie sat back, and I took her in. It was the first that we'd seen each other since the dinner party at the Beresford. She was wearing a silky blue dress with full-length sleeves and a low neckline. Her hair was as straight as if she'd ironed it. She pulled it behind her ears, giving full visibility to the scar on her cheek. A thin white line suggestive of experiences that parlor girls only dream of. It had begun to look glamorous. We both smiled.
Happy birthday, hot stuff, I said. Do I deserve it?
Do you ever? Here was the setup. For her birthday, Tinker said she could rent out a ballroom. She told him that she didn't want a party. She didn't even want presents. All she wanted was to buy a new dress and have dinner for two at the Rainbow Room. That should have been my first clue that something was in the works. The car and driver weren't Tinker's. They were Wallace's. When Wallace heard about Eve's wishes, he had given her the car for the day as a present so that she could go from store to store. And she had made the most of it. In the morning, she had worked her way down Fifth Avenue on reconnaissance. Then, after lunch, she circled back with Tinker's money and launched a full-fledged attack. She bought the blue dress at Bergdorf's, the new shoes at Bendel's, and a bright red alligator clutch at Saks. She even paid for the lingerie. She was fully outfitted with an hour to spare, so she'd come looking for me because she wanted to have a drink with an old friend before she turned 25 in the clouds over Rockefeller Center. And I was plenty glad she did. Behind a panel in the passenger door, there was a bar. It had two decanters, two tumblers, and a sweet little ice bucket. Eve poured me a jigger of gin. She poured herself a double.
Whoa, I said. Don't you think you should be pacing yourself? Don't worry, I've been practicing.
We clinked glasses. She took a mouthful of the gin and ice chips. She crunched the ice as she looked out the window, reflecting on something. Without looking back, she said, "Doesn't New York just turn you inside out?" Located in a little townhouse off Fifth Avenue, the Explorers had been a second-rate naturalists and adventurers club that went bankrupt after the crash. What little it possessed of value had been spirited away in the night by the well-meaning to the Museum of Natural History. The rest, a misassembly of curios and keepsakes, had been left behind by the creditors to gather the dust it had deserved in the first place. In 1936, some bankers who had never been outside of New York bought the building and reopened the club as a high-end watering hole. When we arrived, the street-level steakhouse was just filling up. We climbed the narrow staircase lined with old photographs of ships and snowy expeditions to the library on the second floor. The library had floor-to-ceiling bookshelves holding the club's carefully assembled collection of 19th-century naturalist texts that nobody would ever read. In the middle of the floor, there were two old display cases, one with South American butterflies and the other with pistols from the Civil War. While all around, in low leather chairs, brokers, attorneys, and captains of industry mumbled sagely. The only other woman in the place was a young brunette with short cropped hair sitting in the far corner under the moth-ridden head of a grizzly. Wearing a man's suit and a white-collared shirt, she was blowing smoke rings and wishing she was Gertrude Stein.
"Right this way," the host said.
As we walked, I could see that in her own way Eve had mastered her limp. Most women would have tried to make it disappear. They would have learned to walk like a geisha, taking small, invisible steps with their hair turned up and their gaze turned down. But Eve didn't hide it at all. In her blue floor-length dress, she swung her left leg awkwardly in front of her, like a man with a club foot. Her heels marked the wooden floor in rough syncopation. The host showed us to a table right in the middle of the room. He put us front and center so that Eve's allure could be appreciated by all. "What are we doing here?" I asked when we sat. "I like it here," she said, looking around at the men with a discerning gaze. "Women drive me crazy." She smiled and patted my hand. "Except for you, of course."
What a relief.
A young Italian with hair parted in the middle appeared from behind a swinging door. Evie ordered champagne. "So," I said, "the Rainbow Room."
"I'm told it's pretty fabdabulous, the 50th floor and all that. They say you can see the planes landing at Idlewild."
"Isn't Tinker afraid of heights?"
"He doesn't have to look down."
The champagne arrived with unnecessary ceremony. The waiter placed a standing ice bucket at Eve's side, and the host did the honors with the cork. Eve waved them off and filled the glasses herself. "To New York," I said.
"To Manhattan," she corrected.
We drank. "Any thoughts for Indiana?" I asked.
"She's a sorry nag. I'm through with her."
"Does she know?"
"I'm sure the feeling's mutual."
"I doubt it." She smiled and refilled our glasses.
"Enough about all that. Tell me something," she prodded.
"What?"
"Anything, everything. How are the girls at Mrs. Martingale's?"
"I haven't seen them in months." This was a white lie, of course, since Fran and I had flapped around a bit. But there was no reason to tell that to Evie. She never liked Fran that much anyhow.
"That's right," she said. "I'm so glad you've gotten your own place. How is it?"
"It's pricier than the boarding house, but now I can burn my own oatmeal and plunge my own commode."
"There's no curfew."
"Not that you'd know it by my bedtime."
"Oh," she said with mock concern. "That sounded sad and lonely."
I picked up my empty glass and waved it at her.
"How are things at the Beresford?"
"A little hectic," she said as she poured.
"We're about to have the bedroom remodeled."
"That sounds fancy."
"Not really. We're just sprucing things up a bit."
"Will you stay there during the renovation?"
"As it happens, Tinker will be visiting clients in London, so I'll just take a room at the Plaza and push them to get the work done before he's back."
A birthday without presents? A business trip to London?